You'd be surprised at how many kids don't know how to grow something, which is wild to me. You know, you give them a packet of seeds and, oh, why are we putting them in this bag? And what's germination? Right? Yeah, we're just trying to pick the winners to put them in the soil, right? And how often do I have to water it? I know. Yes, we got to talk about that, right?
Okay. I need some crowdsourcing. Give me
And those are seniors. Those are 18-year-olds that are going off to college next year, and they haven't had very many experiences doing that sort of stuff. So it's very empowering for them, I think, sometimes, because they'll just run to the back of the classroom and check on their babies. That's what they call them. They check on their babies every day. Oh, it's growing in my mouth, you know? And that could be an 18-year-old boy that's all, you know, oh, football. And he's going back there looking to see if his coneflower is growing, which is fantastic. But they don't have those experiences. So I think as long as you put them in front of them, you know, humans are inquisitive by nature. We just got to show them that it's okay to be inquisitive still, right?
Igniting sparks of curiosity in the next generation is a large part of Jeff Grant's life and something he remembers from his own childhood.
We were a family that would go outdoors a lot, you know, so exploring and playing around. And we would sit down as a family and we would be watching nature shows, watching Marty Stouffer's Great Outdoors and things like that.
Like most people, I'm fascinated by any creature that lives in total independence from humans. I've always wanted to get closer, to understand what makes them truly wild.
Yeah, so I try to emulate what those scientists are doing. I can remember specifically being a little kid and going out to the rivers back behind our houses and pretending like I was finding fossils and wrapping them like paleontologists would with newspaper. We would go fishing as family, and my dad would be there to discuss what was going on with the fish. And so we were just an outdoor family. Yeah. So I think that was probably the initial spark. And since then, it's just been burning.
If you're wondering what that spark was for, the answer is science. Welcome to Living Planet. I'm Neil King. And in this episode, we're exploring the vital role science teachers play in helping the next generation understand climate change. And how, against a backdrop of climate denial, underfunding, and fossil fuel groups with deep pockets, educators sometimes have their work cut out for them.
Yeah. Back of your head. This is more for me instructing the other teachers than anything else. All right.
Jeff Grant originally planned to study medicine, but after he began helping out at a nature center, he had a change of heart. He switched to follow in the footsteps of his father, who was a science teacher for more than 30 years. Now, after more than two decades of teaching high school science in Illinois, he's earned a reputation for igniting young minds. And along the way, he picked up a prestigious Golden Apple Award for excellence in teaching.
Just say left organism, right organism, or if you want to say a color designation, so does she have...
For the last, I would say, decade and a half, I've just seen more and more of the things that I grabbed to learn. So textbooks, I don't read textbooks on a fun basis. Let's put that on the record. I'm not that much of a nerd. But when I go to like a Barnes & Noble, I always browse the science section to grab books that I want to read, right? So I read a science book every morning, reading a fantastic one right now by Kate Marvel, it's very good. But it's just seeing more on the shelves that are connected to climate change stuff.
Books aside, the volume of papers related to rising global temperatures has risen so exponentially in the past decade that even dedicated individuals like Jeff would struggle to keep up. Some research estimates there are now more than 85,000 studies published on the topic, and a quarter of them were published in just the past 5 years.
Try to stay away from technical terms in case another group has no idea what you're talking about.
He says he has seen the topic trickle into the curriculum in his state off the back of discussions in classrooms. But he personally has taken a very resolute approach to making sure his students learn about the climate crisis.
I personally bake it in, so to speak. So my game plan is start really big, go way down to the cells, and then come back out again with evolution at the very end. And so they're seeing climate connected to ecology, but then they also see it connected to things like evolution later on in the school year as well.
Evolution can be a hot-button teaching topic in some US classrooms, according to Glenn Branch. He is deputy director of the non-profit National Center for Science Education, founded in the 1980s, to prevent creationism from being taught alongside or instead of science. But over the years, the NCSE has witnessed a growing need to protect another scientific discipline.
About 15 years ago or so, we noticed, and other people noticed, that there were attacks on climate change education beginning to emerge. We were monitoring them because they often traveled with attacks on evolution education. Eventually, we decided that the problems and the solutions were similar enough that NCSE should take on the task of defending climate change education as well.
That takes the form of providing professional development to teachers across the country, offering science teaching resources, and investigating what students are being taught. He sees it as an imperative that young people should understand the world they are living in.
Today's students are tomorrow's consumers, workers, and voters, and they're going to be faced with a series of challenges due to the disruptions caused by climate change. And in order to deal with these challenges wisely, they'll have to have at least the basic understanding of climate change and its impacts and solutions.
Which takes us right back to education. A report published this year by the Aspen Institute found that US teens don't have a confident understanding of climate change. Only 12% said they felt they know a lot about its causes, and over half of those asked regarded recycling as being the solution with the greatest impact. But the often complex and abstract nature of climate science can turn young minds off. So the key to plugging the knowledge gap, says Glenn Branch, is making the topic relatable.
Teachers who are teaching climate change will work to make it relevant. One way to do so is to make it local. Practically everywhere in the United States is being affected in one way or another. Climate change isn't just something that's happening to polar bears in the Arctic or people who live on tiny tropical islands in the South Pacific. It's in your backyard.
Two to three things that are similar, two to three things that are different.
For Jeff, that means introducing his students to things like range maps, to explore how invasive species are spreading further north now that the winters are no longer as cold as they once were, or even just looking at unusual weather on the doorstep.
So it's great to talk about, oh, here's, you know, what's happening with flooding on the coast of Florida, but it's not as powerful as, well, here's why we're starting to get more tornadoes in Illinois. That is more impactful, and they see that, you know, and oh, why did we have this massive hail storm in June? You know, what are the possible implications of that? How frequently has that been happening over the last three decades? That's stuff that they can look at, and they can see it because it happened to them or around them.
Climate education at school has the broad backing of older Americans. According to Yale University research, three quarters of adults in the country want to see it incorporated into the classroom. But not all science teachers bring climate into the classrooms. And because the US school system is highly decentralized, there's no unified curriculum. Decisions about what to teach are not made at the federal or state level, but by the local school district. And with some 13,000 districts across the country, Glenn from the NCSE says it can lead to wildly different approaches to education. He adds, though, that other factors are also at play.
Because climate change is relatively new to American science education, today's teachers are being asked to teach material that they never had the opportunity to learn themselves. Now, teachers are professionals like lawyers and doctors. They undergo continuing education all the time. Learning new material and being able to package it for their students is nothing new, but it's still an uphill battle.
Which might be a good moment to remember those 85,000 studies and counting. In other words, it is easy to be overwhelmed by the sheer volume of available information. Add to that a rising tide of misinformation and disinformation spreading online and through well-funded campaigns, and teachers can feel like they're swimming against the current. The leading avenue for intentionally spreading inaccurate or misleading narratives about human-caused climate change is social media. But research published this year also highlights the role of conservative think tanks, industrial lobbies, and scientific hired hands in spreading skepticism. And the situation has been exacerbated by the Trump administration's climate denial policies and strategies.
The federal government used to have something called a website called climate.gov, which was sort of the hub for all of the federal government's education and outreach efforts on climate change. And most of the staff has been laid off. And the result is that a lot of the content from climate.gov has gone missing.
There are concerns that more information will go missing or be replaced by climate change denial propaganda. So with the help of donations from the public, the staff of the climate.gov website have now regrouped to bring the site back as an independent non-profit. Renamed climate.us, it's planning to reinstate classroom resources designed by teachers and reviewed by scientists. In addition, even if there is no unity, many states do have teaching guidelines. The Next Generation Science Standards were introduced in 2013 to set learning goals, some of which include climate change. But because they are not obligatory, they are not a foolproof guarantee that the science of the subject will reach young ears. And in Jeff's eyes, the standards could go further.
I know that Illinois has a state standard that you need to have climate change as part of your curriculum. Somewhere in the, 14-year-old to 18-year-old time range, there has to be something in the curriculum that addresses climate change, right? And that it's human-influenced climate change that's affecting what we see in front of us right now. But not every state does that, right? Not every state has that as part of their curriculum. But even when you say that, right, when you give, well, here's the standard, you have to cover this standard, they don't give you explicit, this is how to do it, this is a lesson to do, right? It's kind of up to the teachers or the school districts to develop those things or find things to help them with that presentation to kids.
Professional organizations such as the National Science Teaching Association have issued statements calling for more and better climate change lessons. And while they offer lesson plans, workshops, and professional development opportunities themselves, they are up against some powerful groups with their own agendas.
There are and have been systematic attempts to provide teachers with misinformation about climate change in the hopes that they will relay it to their students. And this has kind of two broad categories of sources. One is material from climate change denial think tanks. These are places like the Heartland Institute, and they're very strongly ideologically motivated.
The Heartland Institute, which describes itself as a free market think tank with deep expertise on education policy and environmental protection, is known for its skepticism of scientific consensus on human-caused climate change. On one of its websites devoted to debunking climate science, it prominently states, "There is no climate crisis." The organization regularly produces videos to back that statement up and has also made efforts to appeal to science teachers to educate their students along the same lines.
In 2017, the Heartland Institute sent packets of material to teachers across the United States with outright blatant climate change denial.
Among other things, the packages included a book called Why Scientists Disagree About Global Warming, and a cover letter asking teachers to let students know that the human impact on climate is debated. The National Science Teaching Association issued an alert in response to what it described as an unprecedented attack and urged teachers to just keep on teaching science. But an NCSE study from around that time revealed the sometimes patchy understanding of climate on the part of educators, which can leave space for yet other groups to get into the classroom, including fossil fuel companies themselves.
There is a industry-funded branch of the Oklahoma state government, for example, that produces supplementary material on fossil fuel use and climate change.
The Oklahoma Energy Resources Board is an agency of the state, founded over 30 years ago. Born, it says, out of a vision to restore land associated with historic well sites and to help support educators across the state, which includes glossy lesson plans and reading resources for teachers and students. Some research suggests the materials reach 98% of Oklahoma school districts.
That material is less blatant. It's less obviously climate change denial than the ideological material, but it can still have a distorting influence.
Oklahoma is the sixth largest oil and gas producing state in the U.S. The industry is a major employer and a major contributor to the local economy. According to one analysis, fossil fuel companies put nearly $89 million into Oklahoma school districts last year.
They provide curriculum and training, and they give teachers, hey, come to our Saturday workshop, and it's all day, but we'll give you $50 and a free lunch, and then you'll have all of these supplies, and you just literally copy the lessons, and you share them with your students.
More on that in a moment. First, meet Melissa Lau. She has been an educator for over 20 years and currently teaches environmental science and biology to 13 to 18-year-olds at a school in her home state of Oklahoma. She is another science teacher who's passionate about what she does.
What brought me into education was just investing in that next generation. I don't have children of my own. That is a personal choice that I made. But I felt like as a member of society, I can still make a difference and invest in that next generation.
And in recent years, that has included making her students aware of climate change and the role that humans continue to play in it.
In 2018, I had an opportunity to work with a project that paired teachers with researchers, and they sent us into the field for a significant amount of time to work with research groups. And I worked with a team from Florida International University studying phenology and vegetation change in the Arctic, and I spent 36 days above the Arctic Circle in Alaska working with this team. I think being in the environment that was the ecosystem that was so fragile and the tundra and seeing the actual effects of a warming planet on the villages that were experiencing sea level rise, just the changes in the ecosystem that you could tell from the data they had been collecting, just how much that had been impacting it. It was something I was always concerned about, but like, you know, oh my goodness, we have people always think about climate refugees being something that's not happening in the United States, but it is. We have villages that are having to completely relocate. They're having to deal with just infrastructure and how to survive, you know, surging seawater.
Up until that point, she had not gone deep into climate in her classes, but during her time away, something shifted.
It just added a level of urgency that I thought I can't be wishy-washy or, oh, well, you know, it's just a little too controversial. I don't want to attack this topic in my coursework at all. So, we'll talk about it quickly and then move right along. It really did bring it home as far as, like, these are real people's lives that are being impacted. I mean, it's urgent and it's happening now.
But having made the decision to explore the impacts of global temperature rise more profoundly with her students, she had to come up with a way to bring it home to them in her landlocked state. And that goes right back to making it something that they can actually relate to.
Climate change looks really different in, you know, where we are in Oklahoma, which is right in the middle of the country. It's a little bit more subtle, but it's still there. With agriculture, that was where you could see the biggest changes and the shifts that farmers are having to make to adjust for the longer droughts, more disease-prone species, like just having to see the way that they're having to change their monoculture and soil conservation to adjust for climate change.
In Oklahoma, most of the land is devoted to farming. Like many others, Melissa has relatives working in both agriculture and the oil industry. From personal experience, she knows just how challenging it can be to talk about the increasingly divisive issue of rising global temperatures.
As soon as I use the term climate change, they would shut it off. It's been politicized to the point where you can't hardly have a conversation about climate change, but I can have a conversation about the changing climate. So that's different. As long as you don't use those trigger words, so to speak, those politicized hot topic words, you can have those conversations. They just don't want to hear climate change and that it's us. It's frustrating.
As frustrating as those conversations with her relatives can be, they've also helped prepare her to tackle the topic with her students.
It does help for me to be able to have that conversation when we start getting into these more sticky topics, that I have that connection of, you know, my family, they cattle ranching and wheat farming. I have family members that drive fuel trucks for oil companies. And so I think that that puts them at ease, because I think a lot of times it is, but, you know, my dad is just trying to make a living. We're trying to feed our family, keep a roof over our heads. It gets personal. Like, you know, your parents are not bad because they happen to work for an oil company, or, you know, they happen to have livestock or grow crops. Like, they're not the villains in this story. So that helps to put them at ease, and they tend to be less defensive.
And once she does get into the material, she tries to teach in a way that doesn't only explain the problem. She also helps them to foster a relationship with the natural environment and maintain a sense of agency.
I always joke with them, it's like the first semester is like, this is our beautiful planet. And then the second semester is like, here's how we've messed it up. They realize, it is us. You know, this can't just be a change in solar radiation or our position as we're moving around the planet. But it has to be balanced with, you know, a hopeful message that, yes, humans are the cause of many of the things that are happening on our planet. But we are also the solution, trying to balance that, because you have to deal with that climate anxiety. Apathy is what I see a lot of, is just apathetic. It's like, well, it's just too big and it's too late. So why are we even bothering?
These questions are answered in her classes, but she is aware of the Oklahoma Energy Resources Board trying to share the space. The OERB is just one of a number of oil and gas bodies operating in different states, such as Kansas, Ohio, and Illinois, and offering educational programs to teachers and students. In Oklahoma, efforts to reach children start early. Through a series of illustrated and now digitized books, the Oklahoma Energy Resources Board introduces young readers to Petro Pete, the main character who takes them on an adventure in a place called Petroville. In one story, Pete wakes up in a world without fossil fuels or anything made from them, including his toothbrush, the tires on his bike, and even his comb.
Which, to me, just goes to show how dependent we have become on fossil fuels and how urgent it is for us to start finding these alternatives, because it's not just energy. It is so much of our lives are impacted and influenced by fossil fuel products.
The books are just one part of a broader set of offerings, including full curricula that, if taught in their entirety, come with rewards like class field trips and workshops with names like Petroactive and Fossils to Fuel. These programs are incentivized with professional development credits and a $100 stipend. Melissa says these kinds of resources might resonate with teachers who feel underprepared to teach what can be an overwhelming subject.
That's very appealing in many ways. You know, if a teacher is like, this seems legit. I mean, there's not anything wrong with the science or incorrect with the science. It just gives the impression of, look how good the fossil fuel industry is. It minimizes the impact.
The literature paints them as the good guys, the ones to be trusted. Jeff Grant has noticed representatives of the fossil fuel industry at education conferences up in Illinois as well, but says the scale of intervention is less extreme than in Oklahoma. But he too understands why some teachers might opt to take part in professional development run by bodies like the Oklahoma Energy Resources Board.
The hardest thing I feel like I have seen with professional development is the money piece, right? I mean, heck, I mean, teachers aren't exactly the best paid position in the country, and these companies, they have a lot of money, so they can throw it that way to try to put their resources with these teachers, and then they'll give them stipends too.
And it is not helped by what Glenn Branch says is a systemic problem in the way schools get their funding.
Some will come from the state, some from the federal government, but the majority is going to be local property taxes, and local property owners tend not to want to pay more taxes.
He says the economic importance of the fossil fuel industry in states where its representatives actively court teachers and students makes it difficult to dislodge the programs they offer, even when parents raise concerns. That's why it's crucial to keep ensuring educators have access to scientifically sound materials and to involve them in helping spread accurate information. And that is where Jeff has become very active. Noticing a gap in available programs, he pitched the idea of a day-long climate education conference for Illinois science teachers to his department chair and got the green light. He teamed up with colleagues from the Golden Apple Academy to bring it to life, hosting the event at his school last year. To make it accessible, it was scheduled on a statewide professional development day. It was a major undertaking, but Jeff says it was absolutely worth it.
So we ended up having about 400 teachers, middle school and high school teachers, come to the high school. We had scientists flying in from different states. We had local organizations giving presentations. So it was a full day of learning for these teachers. They were learning nothing but climate change, science-based stuff, from labs to presentations from great speakers. It was just knock your socks off, fantastic day.
And the feedback was so good that he's involved in planning another conference for early next year.
The amount of people at the end of the day, they were like, oh, I really needed this. This was fantastic. You know, and when you go to that conference and you talk with other science teachers that want to do more and, you know, they're going through the same frustrations, it's very empowering. It's a hopeful thing. It's not, you know, gloom and doom. You can do this. The kids can do this. 2100 is the year to shoot for. Let's get on the correct trajectory.
We'll be right back after this short message.
I'm Samir Patel, editor-in-chief at Quanta Magazine. Our mission at Quanta is to cover what we call basic or fundamental research in science and math. That means the kind of work that's driven by curiosity and discovery and the search for knowledge. We're interested in how and why everything around us works the way that it does. On our brand new show, The Quanta Podcast, you'll meet the writers and editors behind the magazine, and together we'll explore the biggest ideas and the tiniest details. Join me for The Quanta Podcast, your weekly dispatch from the frontiers of science and math.
In an ideal world, Jeff would love to see the concept expanded into other states. Reaching more teachers he knows would benefit from having the time and space to talk and hear about the topic and how to integrate it into their lesson plans.
We're hoping. We're really hoping, because we don't operate with a budget. I don't get paid. The other people that are doing this, they're not getting paid. The hardest part is, you know, we're reaching Illinois teachers. You know, how do you get started in Indiana? How do you get started in Washington? I don't know. I don't know the answer to that, but we're hopeful that it would be something that could be done in other places.
Melissa Lau has been asking herself questions along those lines because there are, she says, some colleagues who don't accept the science. That was one reason why she got involved with the National Center for Science Education. Earlier this summer, she presented some of their climate change resources to the state's educators, hoping it would help remove some of the obstacles to teaching climate change.
There was probably 20 or 30 educators there, which to me, I felt like that was a huge success. And then the feedback that we were receiving were these were teachers that, you know, would be, you know, they were excited about using that curriculum in their classrooms.
She'd love to do more of that kind of work and says her local school boards and authorities are supportive and interested in how her teaching can help prepare students for the future. But that same level of encouragement isn't coming from the state or federal level.
As a teacher, I always felt like I needed to hold myself to a higher standard on social media, just as an example for my students. But now just about anything can get me on our state superintendent's radar. You know, I'm not too concerned about that, but I know for a lot of teachers, it's especially terrifying right now to speak out or say anything that can be seen as indoctrination.
And that in itself could make bigger events that are open to teachers from across the state harder to pull off.
I think teachers right now would feel like it would put them on some sort of list. So I don't know. I don't know how well that would be received if they were starting to get into the teaching climate change, but they're not as passionate about it. You know, this is my 26th year. I'm a union member. I've got lawyers. I'm good. But there are others that are, you know, they're just starting their careers. This is not necessarily something that they're wanting to get under fire and have to fight for 30 plus years of their career.
Ultimately, she says there's a need to shift mindsets around the climate crisis and to depoliticize it so people can begin to see it for what it truly is.
It's not about vilifying individual humans. Yes, the oil and fossil fuel industry has misled us in the same way that the tobacco industry had done to us in the 50s. But this isn't a morality issue. This isn't an identity issue. This is a humanitarian crisis. And no matter what side of the political spectrum you stand on, this is our greatest existential human crisis that we have to be dealing with. It is not right versus left crisis.
Interestingly, and maybe encouragingly, she says her students tend to understand the role of humans in the climate crisis in a way that adults sometimes don't. And that chimes with Jeff's own experience in class.
They just go with it. I mean, there's not a resistance. It's not something that they combat or that they see. Well, this isn't what I've been learning, right? All my life. No, the debt is there. It's not hard for them. Kids are very resilient. Kids are very smart.
And they're also, as Jeff continues to witness, curious. Besides teaching, he also hosts a science club at his school. And last year, he took 5 students to a state competition around environmental knowledge. They didn't win, but they did come away inspired.
And those 5 kids coming back for that are like, we really need to do more stuff. I was like, all right, well, what do you want to do?
When he mentioned this enthusiasm to a contact from the American Geoscience Group a couple of days later, she made a suggestion.
She goes, oh, well, you know, we're trying to work with kids to develop rain gardens. I was like, what's a rain garden? And she told me, and I told the kids, and like, we should make one at our school. And I said, yeah.
For clarity, a rain garden is not a wetland, but an area where native plants are dug into a small depression. The idea is that it can temporarily hold water that runs off from rooftops of paved areas. That water then filters into the surrounding soil.
If you pick the right plants, they can clean up that water before it goes down there as well. So the rain garden concept is just decreasing ecological footprint. So the kids pitched it to the administration, and guess what? We put one in. It was fantastic.
He says teaching kids about science and climate change is about trying to help them understand and better navigate the world. But he also sees it as an opportunity for them to learn how to become aware of their role in it.
Be conscientious that you're part of the world, right? And that it's a global phenomenon. It's not just the United States. I think if they walk away from class like that, then that's a positive.
This episode of Living Planet was produced by Tamsin Walker and edited by me, Neil King. Our sound engineer was Christian Stetter. Did you like this episode? We'd love to hear from you. Our email address is livingplanet@dw.com. Of course, any ratings or reviews on the podcast platform of your choice are also very welcome. That's it. Thanks for listening, and bye for now.
There are two kinds of people in the world. People who think about climate change and people who are doing something about it. On the Zero podcast, we talk to both kinds of people. People you've heard of, like Bill Gates.
I'm looking at what the world has to do to get to zero, not using climate as a moral crusade.
And the creative minds you haven't heard of yet. It is serious stuff, but never doom and gloom. I am Akshat Rathi. Listen to Zero every Thursday from Bloomberg Podcasts on Apple, Spotify, or anywhere else you get your podcasts.